But with the neoliberals, they do believe in the state at the end of the day, and really they believe in outcomes. And so this allows the justification for, you know, a China or for any other country that is seeing results for its citizens without necessarily granting them, you know, civil society rights, without having democracies, without having elections, without people having a say in how they're governed.
Hello, I am Cody Allingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Roger Huang. Roger is the author of Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? The Past, Present, and Future of Bitcoin in Techno-Nationalist China. Roger is a frequent Bitcoin commentator and speaker, writing for publications such as Forbes, while also running a company. But how have you been, Roger? You're all good?
Yeah, I'm all good. Yeah, it's been a while since we saw each other. Missing Tokyo, missing Asia just in general, but I think it's, you know, it's always good to be running around North America as well, I guess.
Yeah. My deep dive over the last few weeks has been this idea of neoliberalism. It's kind of weird. A lot of things have been happening in the Bitcoin world, in the real world, all over the show, and it got me kind of onto this track of, okay, well, where did all of this come from? And neoliberalism has been the dominant political and economic regime since the 1980s, and most people have no idea what it is, though. No doubt, though, they've experienced its impact. Bitcoiners talk about fiat money ruining everything, but I do wonder if we are actually describing, at least in part, the consequences of 40 years of neoliberalism. Roger, obviously this is a big topic, but how do you think we can begin to understand what neoliberalism is?
Yeah, I thought it was interesting. So you had sent me a couple of things. I've been kind of like digesting it as well, because just full context, like sometimes Cody just reaches out and is like, we want to talk about this really big topic, and you've got like 24 hours to think about it. So it's kind of like me and the 24 hours, but I always appreciate Cody and, you know, all the good content that he's bringing. I think specifically, like a couple of interesting strands for me to pick on is, one is just, you know, kind of like what you mentioned, where Bitcoin is at, and not just like the price or anything like that, but really like the philosophical undercurrents. Sort of, are we defining terms the right way? Are we aiming the right way? I just saw this post about not naming names, but it's like, you know, prominent Bitcoiner X does not understand the philosophical underpinnings of Bitcoin. And it's like, do Bitcoiners, or most Bitcoiners, or people who describe themselves as Bitcoiners, understand any of the philosophical underpinnings? That's, I think, an open question. So definitely a lot to tug on there. I have a few thoughts. And I think it was something interesting. One of the sources that you gave me, the gentleman called Silvers, I believe his name is.
Damon Silvers, yeah.
Who's kind of like, I think you broke it down in an interesting way. You kind of had like a source that was supposed to be the Marxist view on neoliberalism, the sort of, maybe I could say, moderate view on neoliberalism. And then you had, you know, the sovereign individual, sort of the panache of Bitcoiners. I think I texted you, I tend to lean in that direction, but can play all three angles if needed. But it was interesting because Silvers did say something that I thought was really interesting to unpack, which is that he really went and doubled down on his idea that China was a neoliberal state or part of the neoliberal project as it currently stands, which I was kind of like thinking through that. And my initial take was that he was half right. But, you know, unpacking that could be a lot of fun. So, yeah, that's kind of like where I was at when you brought up this topic.
Yeah. Well, let's go back a step, though. I mean, definitions again, though. So it's one of these funny things where, in fact, neoliberalism itself is actually quite paradoxical and difficult to nail down. It can almost mean anything to anybody. And so I think, though, the generally accepted consensus is that it is the regime that emerged in the late 1970s and certainly in the 1980s with the figures of Reagan and Thatcher really leading the charge. But there were a lot of people behind them who, I guess, led the conceptual development of it. And what it was really is a new economic regime that really prioritizes free market fundamentalism. It really encourages a deregulation of things that were previously done by the state in a lot of cases, a move towards privatization, etc. These were the actions, I guess, and this is one of the things I think we'll find with neoliberalism, is that what it says and what it is can sometimes be two different things. But certainly right. People will be aware that, you know, once upon a time, you know, certainly before World War II, you had the New Deal, you had big government, you had the, you know, kind of the Roosevelt years, followed by this period after the war of what is commonly called embedded liberalism. And this is very much the kind of, you know, the golden age of America in many ways, the 1950s and certainly the early 1960s. And then there was a crisis, though, at a certain point. And this sort of tends to kind of coalesce around that period that many Bitcoiners will be familiar with, 1971. But certainly the early 1970s and the oil shocks, there was a lot of questions as to, okay, has this thing run its course? Has embedded liberalism, the way the state and the private sector and I guess the various countries around the world were working, you know, had that run its course? And then there was this very rapid move in the early 1980s towards, again, deregulation, free market fundamentalism, and selling that to the public. And so there's a lot more there that we can tug on. But I think maybe just for people who haven't really encountered it, that's sort of, I would say, from my perspective, sort of some of the key tenets. Have you got anything you think we should add to that kind of list, the laundry list of what neoliberalism could be?
Yeah, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of, like, neoliberalism can be very loose, very loosely defined. I think actually going into it and into the different elements, you start to get a little bit more specific. I think, like, the history that you said is largely right. It's basically a response to the social democracy, the more kind of big state vision. You know, remember Lyndon B. Johnson and the Great Society and everything related with that after World War II, right? Mm. And certainly there's that. I think one element that I tend to fixate on, because I'm always interested in the philosophy behind it, is it's not just a, you know, political leadership. It's a whole economic system as well as a philosophical system, right? And it grabs its roots in a similar place to where Bitcoiners think as well. So there is some intersect. And really, you see kind of the same philosophers, Hayek, you know, and others, Rothbard, although Rothbard might be a little bit more hardcore, I think you would say, and Friedman, right? Milton Friedman. You see kind of like that same coalition. And I think two things that occurred to me as I was kind of looking at this, and then we can kind of go into defining it even more, but, you know, the actual political economic effect, I think you can argue, is some configuration of that, like, response to the oil shocks in the 1970s, the stagflation, for those of your viewers not familiar. You know, obviously there was the Yom Kippur War, and then basically Israel, well, you can argue, was attacked at the time. And then essentially the Arab states refused to export oil, which created, they embargoed the states they perceived to be supporting Israel, which then created this, like, massive stagflation, which was basically increase in prices, and then people were also getting unemployed. Mm-hmm. So very, very uncomfortable. And there were a lot of thinkers, Milton Friedman was one of them, who were saying, like, you know, this is a consequence of the welfare state gone amok. You know, you can only hide behind the spend for so long. The long-run consequences of, you know, keeping rates lower than they should be is this version of stagflation. Obviously, there's a famous quote that inflation is a monetary phenomenon only, right? So I'm not trying to parrot the Friedman view, but just that's kind of like the where that comes from. And you can argue that it has had its effect through all kinds of different things, from the Washington Consensus, which is sort of the late 90s, 90s view towards broader liberalization, using the United States as auxiliary arms in terms of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, right? In order to really bring this kind of vision of privatization, sector by sector privatization, into other countries, right? Yeah. What I think is kind of important to think about here is that all this happened, it's not in a void. Like, there is a philosophical underpinning behind this, right? But the philosophical underpinning may miss a few things. Now, I'm just going to sum up some of the counterarguments against. One very common one is that, you know, as you alluded to, a version of free market fundamentalism does undermine democracy in the sense that it will tend to increase the power of the private sector, of your bosses, and things like that, right? And so a common story, and I think Silvers tells this, is that, you know, there was unionism and labor was able to capture a fair share of wages. But then after the 1970s and after the deregulation, that was no longer the case. And in fact, real wages have not increased since then, right? In Western developed countries. So I do think there is, for example, Hayek and all these thinkers, they were very focused on the letting the free market be free and letting the outcomes speak for themselves. But I think they made a couple of fatal misapprehensions. One, most fundamental, and going back to the point I just made, that capitalism and free market capitalism automatically brings democracy, or that the two are automatically correlated. And in fact, what I think China's example brings up, which is the thing that stirs up all the time, is that that probably is not true. And demonstrably so, because China has proven an example of having an authoritarian state that has some free market principles, or more free market principles than it used to have. I'm just wrapping it all the way back. Hopefully that helps with some of the definitions, context, some of my thoughts on this topic.
Yeah. So it's interesting. A couple of sources that I've been reading into have given quite a powerful history of the first neoliberal experiment. And so if we go back, you mentioned Hayek, Milton Friedman. So these gentlemen were just after World War II part of a group called the Mount Parolin Society, which was formed, I think it might have been like some spa or some kind of, you know, resort town in Switzerland.
I think
Switzerland.
It was a resort town, yeah.
Yeah, in Switzerland somewhere. And it was this group that advocated freedom of expression, free market economic policies, and an open society, and really trying to find ways for the private sector to replace the roles and functions that were provided by the state. And this was, I guess you could say, this was kind of a bit of a fringe movement. It wasn't really considered mainstream in that period, but these guys kept sort of chipping away at it. And one of the moments that is talked about in a couple of the readings that I've been going through is the Chilean coup. So in 1973, there was a CIA-backed coup to overthrow the elected leader of Chile and install General Pinochet. And it was really quite fascinating to actually learn that Milton Friedman met with General Pinochet, and these Mount Parolin economists basically set up the first neoliberal state in Chile in the 1970s.
Yeah.
And this is, again, speaking to that piece of democracy versus authoritarianism, you know, General Pinochet, well known for, you know, imprisoning journalists and beating people with rubber hoses and all sorts of things. It's sort of this project, this monetarist reform, and so monetarism, which is the idea that you can, the control of the money supply is the best way to guarantee a stable economy, which has echoes with Bitcoin. But certainly the experiment of deregulation and the neoliberal revolution, in a sense, you could say, in 1973 onwards in Chile, was quite a profound kind of test bed, and in a sense it didn't work for, I think, for a few months or maybe a year or so. There was some signs of improvement, but as things started wobbling, the inability of the state to intervene, that, you know, this kind of cutting off of the state's capabilities led to a lot of challenges and a lot of kind of economic regression. And so this kind of necessity of neoliberalism to kind of have an enforcement arm that isn't democratic is quite fascinating, because it also leads to us seeing kind of that idea of free market fundamentalism, which I think we can look at as the idea that unregulated markets create optimum social outcomes. And this is also, I think, presaged by the idea that markets precede the state. And it's actually quite interesting from a Bitcoin perspective. There's quite a well-known video. What's Our Problem? Joe Bryan put it together. And I interviewed Joe. He's a great guy. He put this video together about this island, you know, and this kind of magical economic kind of scenario. And what I find very interesting about that, which isn't a criticism on Joe, but just a critical look at that perspective, is that, you know, at what point did we ever have a fresh start and have some magical island that we could go inhabit, except perhaps in the era of colonialism? And so the idea that, you know, we're going to be all magically educated and well-rounded, civil, liberal-minded people going and inhabiting an island, it doesn't work like that. And in fact, what happens with society is we inherit a whole lot of stuff, good and bad, and we have to work with it. And so kind of the logic of democracy is that there is and of liberalism, I think, in general, is that there is an arena where you can you can voice an opinion, you can push back, and then theoretically in a democracy, the voice of the people can speak. And sometimes that what that means is the voice of the people say, hey, we need to curtail the market, or we need to change this, we need to change that. And that is the kind of feedback mechanism. However, with free market fundamentalism, you sort of cut that off. And so we say, okay, you can do anything you want except reform the market. And so I think this leads to, again, some of these contradictions and paradoxes that we can steel man or straw man, however we feel. But it's quite interesting, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think because the other thing I was going to say is that neoliberals are not necessarily, I mean, again, we're kind of like hitting on the vagueness a little bit of like who, what, and exactly what we believe, what neoliberals believe, because I'm not actually a neoliberal, I should say. But, you know, I think that with all of the essential parts of whatever you can construe as a neoliberal ideology, I think Bitcoiners are kind of more in this sovereign individual frame, right? Which you can argue is more against the state or more restrictive of the state in certain respects. You know, one thing I should say about the whole Pinochet thing, and then we can kind of go from there, because I do think that the Pinochet thing shows kind of like how neoliberals were still like people who considered the state to be essential to their goals. Now, I do want to nuance it a little bit. I think Milton Friedman actually did visit Pinochet, but ended up condemning him towards some point. But Hayek actually was someone who did not. And I think part of the reason why Hayek did not was because Hayek believed that there could be kind of like a transitional government. There could be a kind of like a dictatorship of the proletariat, but instead it's a dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, I guess you could say, that could bring the state into some desired end order, right? For him, it would be small L liberties, economic and political liberties for all. Because Hayek did consider himself to be a defender of democracy as well as markets, right? He kind of thought the two went hand in hand. I think the issue with that is that you do have this long-standing belief in allegiance with the state. I think there is, you know, obviously, and in Hayek and in Friedman, by the way, there are, you know, paeons back to needing the state to enforce their policies. For example, Milton Friedman was a big fan of the negative income tax. So namely, he wasn't necessarily against the welfare state that redistributed resources. He was more against the bureaucracy that created it. But in essence, he still was allied with a state. He did have to think through state mechanics. Hayek was the same way. Like Hayek actually made an argument, however tentative, it was quite strong and bold for a universal basic income. That is one thing that he's written about, for example. And I think this thread of thought allows us to understand a little bit more. Sorry, I'm just always like Bitcoin brain rotted. So we're taking all these like big themes and I'm thinking about our little corner of the world of Bitcoiners, right? And, you know, this helps explain to me like people who are into Bitcoin's tenets, but also like very big Trumpians or very big MAGA people. I think it's like almost the exact same kind of like correlation. And you have to look at people, no matter what you can say about Robert Nozick, obviously Anarchy, State, and Utopia, and that kind of brand of libertarian. And of course, Nozick ended up stepping away from his vision of a libertarian ideal society as well. But he was actually coming at it from a, like, you know, a natural rights framework, an ideal world framework, where libertarianism was justified based off of natural rights, meaning that even if it was inefficient, it made sense to do. I think Hayek and others were much more the other way around, Milton Friedman as well. It was like more that we have this very baseline view, and they're very candid about it. They're like, we don't have a subjective moral view on what people do with these different outcomes. If the economy is doing well, you can spend your money on whatever. It's actually not on me to prescribe to you. That's part of my philosophy and tenet, is that like there is no necessarily moral value. Now, they believed in social values, they believed in public goods, all this other stuff, but there wasn't necessarily like a strict moral standard for that. But with the neoliberals, they do believe in the state at the end of the day, and really they believe in outcomes. And so this allows the justification for, you know, a China or for any other country that is seeing results for its citizens without necessarily granting them, you know, civil society rights, without having democracies, without having elections, without people having a say in how they're governed, right? So I think that's something I would just sum up. Like, I think it's fascinating to think about all these different currents, and that neoliberals may not represent every view of people who are against or moderating the state. And in fact, their point of view is actually still dependent on the state to a certain degree.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that. Like, another text I've been reading is Beyond the New Right by John Gray. And I picked this up in a secondhand bookstore randomly. I just sort of found it. And it, literally, like, on the first page, it blows my mind. It says, for the libertarian and classical liberal ideologues of the new right, aka the neoliberals, their ideas were truly what Marxism had falsely promised to be, the riddle of history solved. And what he's really saying is this enlightened idea that we could kind of find the answer to history. And even if it's painful, and it sounds, there's a lot of echoes with communism there, that even if it's painful for a short while, you know, we'll get through it, and then we end up with the free market utopia, in the case of Marxism, the communist utopia. But it is a historical material view of history, that, you know, we work through it and we get to the golden paradise. And what this book actually, and this is written in the 90s, just as the kind of the Blair years were unfolding in the UK as neoliberalism was rolled out even more, what it's really arguing for in this book is actually a move back to conservatism, which, again, one of these words that people don't fully understand maybe, but the idea fundamentally of conservatism is that human institutions are imperfectible, and that you have to assume that they're broken and they're not going to be perfect, but that you can still work with that. And that's where the arena of democracy and social discourse and free press and all of that stuff comes in. And so I've got, you know, highlights on every page, sort of seeing how he's breaking it down in the early 90s as this thing was taking off. And I find that quite interesting because, you know, in my corner of Bitcoin, you know, certainly we've got an unfolding war in the Middle East led by the United States at this point. It's quite interesting. It's like, okay, yeah, I don't think that's a good thing. I've got a lot of issues with that, and it's led by the state. If we defunded the state and we separated state and money, all of these things we talk about, you know, does that lead to a better outcome? However, another way of sort of framing that is like, okay, did the separation of money and state already happen? And it happened in the 1980s, and that led to the development of Wall Street and the London Stock Exchange and all of these things becoming the epicenters of global finance. And that way Damon Silvers talks about this in his lecture that I sent you, it's sort of the regression of state power has led to the development of private power. And it's not a free market in the sense where you and I are now empowered. It's like, yeah, these quasi, you know, the private actors, but quasi state actors, such as global finance, global capital, big tech, are now the ones, you know, driving this thing, Halliburton and Palantir and who knows who. It's sort of, there's this kind of mismatch, and basically it comes down to a power game, it seems. And I guess what I want to get to on the Bitcoin side, obviously I'm a very interested in this, and it seems to me, one way of framing this, Roger, is that pleb Bitcoiners like me and you have kind of slipped in the door on the coattails of these elite neoliberal sovereign individual types who are the kinds of people like Elon Musk and that who, you know, what kind of individual person can put a rocket into space? You know, that was, I think, something, again, Damon Silvers speaks of is the majesty of NASA, you know, the greatest achievement of humanity to put man on the moon. You've now got someone like Elon Musk sending these rocket ships up, you know, under his own name, effectively. And the only way that was possible is because he's usurped some of that kind of power of the state. And it's almost like some of the plebs, we've kind of like slipped in on that, and it's like, oh, we've got a taste of what it's like to be beyond the reach of any kind of power structure. And I think that's quite an interesting way of framing it. And so in a sense, we're almost complicit with, you know, let's say that, you know, these kinds of power brokers and elite people, and we just don't know it, and we think we're sort of in our own little world. It's a lot to work with. I mean, what do you think?
Well, as another pleb, you know, got to take some time to think this through. No, I'm kidding. one thing I would say about that is, you know, that was always a fundamental philosophical kind of battle between anarchists to the left and anarchists to the right. Right, anarchists, anarcho-capitalists, and anarchists. And the whole idea was that anarcho-capitalists would preserve still the ruling hierarchy and the ruling order, right? That the state, in fact, is needed to enforce private property. Like, one thing I always, when I'm talking with anarcho-capitalists, it always comes down to, they're like, we believe in a state that's fully contractualized. Everybody's just running contracts, and we're all like in a private sector. We all have contracts. But I'm like, at the end of the day, who enforces these contracts, right? It's the people with the guns. So it all comes down kind of the same thing. So anarchists to the left have always made that point since Proudhon, since the 1800s, which is that property itself, you know, property rights require a state to enforce, right? That in effect, the hierarchies and the ways that we do or conduct an economy or do business, right, require a state to support. And I think the thing with China is like that, it's almost like the illusion is not even really there anymore, or that it's easier to see that illusion. I find China to be really fascinating as a lens, because people have this conception of it, right? And then if they see things within China, they don't see it within their own state or polity, but it's still happening. So in China, they have unions. Everyone's a member of a union, in fact. You know, they have, you can argue, strong labor rights from a nominal standpoint. I mean, everybody belongs to a union. Everybody votes in said union. Is that not, you know, labor controlling everything? But when you break down the narrative, right, I mean, the average factory worker has very little power. The average gig worker in China has very, very little power, right, over their living conditions and their lives. So the same thing is true, I think, of the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, all these other Commonwealth polities. But it requires you to like look through the lens of a society you're trained to be like, this is wrong, in order for you to really see it, right? And so to what you said about, you know, are we just coat riding the elites? Probably, to a certain extent.
I was just going to say, so on that piece, and I guess to steelman that, obviously, you know, I think and I still, you know, I spend my days, you know, working on Bitcoin stuff. You know, this is very important to me, but it's interesting that sort of the argument that, you know, and I do pick up on this, that there is a facade that is useful to us. And I think the facade of human rights, for example, the facade that, you know, Bitcoin could be used for people, from people who are trying to escape an oppressive regime. Yes, you know, that could, if you were already set up for that. But if you're experiencing currency collapse now, it's kind of too late. And so there's almost this idea that, you know, that's a useful story, and it's kind of a nice fluffy story that we can tell ourselves. But the reality is it's a way of getting your money out before things get bad, and sort of presaging it. And so that is necessarily situates it as kind of more of an elite, in the know kind of technology. And that, I mean, that maybe isn't 100% true, but it's sort of, in my experience talking to people about Iran, and certainly, you know, personal connections through Russia and that sort of thing, there's people that I know who are like, yeah, it's too late to get, you know, to get money out of Russia into Bitcoin. There's no liquidity in the market. It's really challenging. You know, if you've got rubles, you're stuck with rubles, basically. Right. And there's a lot of these kinds of stories. And you come back to you talk about China, and I think it's quite illuminating that you're talking about labor unions. So when was the last time any of us really talked about labor unions? You know, like, it's not really a thing. I mean, I think when I had like my first job out of high school, I think, you know, it was a retail job, and they were like, do you want to join the union? And I was like, no, why do I want to do that? Why would I want to pay my dues? What are you guys going to do for me? Whereas, as the sovereign individual talks about, certainly in the middle of the 20th century, the labor unions were some of the most powerful entities on earth. They could shut down a country, you know, coal miners' strikes and wharf workers' strikes and things like this, you know, were major challenges. And there was a sense that they had this kind of political power of the working class. And even then, what does that mean, the working class? You know, I don't, you know, this is Marxist terminology, but, you know, you and I are sort of petty bourgeoisie, you know, information workers with our computers. When was the last time our soft hands ever touched like a hard machinery of a factory, you know? And so we don't know. But it's interesting with China. I was surprised to learn, actually, independent trade unions are illegal. Everyone has to affiliate with the All China Federation of Trade Unions. And that's sort of
that's correct. There is the nominal construction of the narrative, right? It's just more obvious and garish in China, because you do sign up to a union. It just happens to be the country's union, and it's more of a political pay-on than it is an actual like negotiating device.
That said, though, I was reading about how there have been increasingly more and more strikes since the COVID years, but a lot of these seem to be organized by sort of small groups, like, you know, just a single factory. Maybe their pay was being withheld, or there was some reason why the workers in that particular place were striking. But this was often really condemned and kind of come down quite hard by the state in China. And one of the turning points, which we're painting quite a big picture here, but again, Damon Silvers talks about how the collapse of the Soviet Union was important, but Tiananmen Square was more important. Crushing democracy in China set the stage for globalization and neoliberalism, along with the removal of Chinese political voice. And so I guess the Marxist angle that we were looking at earlier was really this idea of like a labor and capital, because the crushing of the labor unions by Thatcher, the coal workers and the miners in England, that set the stage now where, again, I don't even know what a union is, really. I've never been a member of a union. Well, like, what is a union? Whereas once upon a time, it was like half the people in the country were members of a union, and they really pushed for that wage increases. And so when you look at that classic Bitcoin graph of WTF 1971, you know, what happened in 1971, and the wages have just kind of declined, quality of living has gone down. Yeah, you could make an argument that that's actually because the power of unions has declined over the last sort of 50 years. And so, I don't know, it seems that labor capital play, which again, it's a Marxist angle, I don't necessarily subscribe to it, but it's sort of, there is an argument there that those two things are connected.
Yeah, I mean, I think there were a lot of things that happened in the 70s. That's one thing I would say. You know, we just covered a few. We covered the Yom Kippur War. We covered the oil shocks. We covered, Vietnam, you know, the changes in terms of governance and everything. Mao also died during the 1970s and the Cultural Revolution ended and then led to Tiananmen. I think you said like two or three interesting threads. Let me poke at a couple of them. Like, so first, I thought you brought up a salient point with the sovereign individual, and I love certain parts of the sovereign individual's vision. And I actually fundamentally, you know, do live my life according to some of those tenets. But I do believe what you're saying, which is that, you know, Bitcoiners and the Bitcoin community at large, sometimes we forget that that is fundamentally kind of, an elite information project, you can say. And, you know, the standard answer is like have fun staying poor or like whatever, which I don't think is a very, very, very good or thought out answer to that fundamental problem, which is that, yes, Bitcoin can be a solution, and certainly it has been used in many instances to be a solution, but you have to know, you have to access it, you have to kind of profess the shibboleths even to really use it. It's actually really specific to Bitcoin, because for a lot of these jurisdictions where it's forbidden or where it's a little verboten, you know, you actually have to know people in the community to be able to effectively use it, because you'd have to self-custody, you have to trade peer-to-peer. So it is an elite kind of project. And we do see that in the distribution of who owns Bitcoin. Now, we spend a lot of time as Bitcoiners talking about how that doesn't really matter. But at the end of the day, there is an increasing concentration. And a lot of those are, you know, showing up in large American corporations and their balance sheets. So that is something to examine for sure. So just something on the sovereign individual. I think on the China front, not to harp too much on it, but you know, the Tiananmen Square period, very, very interesting, because it was really the beginning of China. Deng Xiaoping, who was the leader after Mao Zedong died during the Cultural Revolution, there was a short interregnum, but Deng for effectively was basically China's paramount leader between the 80s to the early 90s. You know, he liked to rule through other people, and it actually was inflation that I think undid some of the, you know, obviously I wrote that book about Bitcoin in China, Would Mao Hold Bitcoin? One of my pet subjects is the amount of inflation that kind of came up during the Tiananmen Square period, and where it wasn't like a primary cause, but it was definitely something that was in the background as there were a lot of protests because people were not used to this. And there were, by and large, two different factions in China at the time. There were political liberals and economic liberals, as well as people who were more economically liberal than Mao, certainly. Wouldn't be very hard to do that, but there were. And, you know, but they were also political conservatives. And what ended up happening after Tiananmen Square was that the party kind of doubled down on effectively saying, we should have free market mechanisms. People can have private enterprise, but the state needs to rule over everything. We're just going to double down on that. And the state's going to control. You know, Mao always said, what's the two most important things? The guns and the bank. So what did he do? He created the People's Bank of China, consolidated all the regional banks, and he enforced party control and discipline over the PLA, right? Over the People's Liberation Army. That was the foundation of his power, and that is something that the party has continued to do. This is where you get into, I could see how Silvers, who I don't really know how much he knows about China, but I could see where he could say the argument that China is a neoliberal project. Because from the outside, it is kind of like this idea that they are more market-driven mechanisms. For example, the central bank is going from a reserve quota system to a more market interest-based targeting system, right? But one thing to fundamentally realize is, just like we talked about, the Chinese state, and I think it's very interesting to listen to the early 1980s, the Chinese leaders who talked about them embracing Wall Street. You know, what a paradox, right? You're a communist society, you're embracing Wall Street. Milton Friedman, speaking of Milton Friedman, also came to see China's leaders. He was racking up all the air miles at the time as well. You know, he wasn't just seeing the Chileans, he also went to go see the Chinese. And you know, you see this dynamic where the Chinese state is allowing for economic liberty, but then is not allowing for political liberty. And sometimes, you know, a great hero of mine is Liu Xiaobo, who went to Tiananmen Square, negotiated kind of the students leaving the square I think morally speaking, I could never hold a candle to him, just to be very clear on this podcast. But I think he did make an error in reasoning, which is very, very similar to Hayek, where they both assume that free markets bring free minds, or some variant of this, right? And what we're seeing in China is that clearly wasn't the case. Tiananmen Square is definitely a doubling down point on the party saying we can have our cake and eat it too, right? You have the mechanics of the market, but you have a strong state kind of overseeing the departments that matter and being able to purge or imprison billionaires at will, with a society that's conditioned to kind of still see wealth as being something somewhat suspect. Yes, it's glorious to get rich, but, you know, remember that our biggest heroes are the ones who died during the Korean War fighting fighting the imperialists, right? So there is always that mix. And then I think maybe just to wrap all that up and not to talk about China for too long, you know, overall, the philosophical dynamic I see is with neoliberalism, I like what you said from the beginning. It's, we know how people think, but we do not, we've seen its impact, but we have not really understood what it means under the hood. Because at the core of it, my belief, and this can be interpreted back and forth, I think there's a lot of word games with these terms, right? And neoliberalism is certainly one that is apt for that. But my belief is that neoliberalism really is the project of saying that the market, I mean, you could say it's free market fundamentalism. I actually kind of like that in the sense that it almost does take on religion-like fervor, you know? And in cases like Hayek, for example, and you see the new generation of people, it's a pity your book wasn't the one Beyond the Right in the 90s. If they rewrote it in 2010, they have a lot more material, right? You have people like Curtis Yarvin, you have others who are basically arguing the Hayekian argument of there can be a transitory state. We need a good king in between. We need to suspend democracy because, you know, let's say, for example, Peter Thiel comes to the conclusion that ever since women have been emancipated, ever since women can vote, libertarians have never won, right? So there is this critical notion that like the end is worth the means, which has its parallels in the Marxist dictatorship of the proletariat. Remember, Marx always said that the state would fade away, right? And in a sense, this is how neoliberals think as well, right? That let the free market do what it can, and the state will by itself fade away. I don't think that's true for a number of different reasons that I can kind of go into. But let me just pause there because I've been like kind of yapping for like a while now.
Yeah. Well, so I think my understanding is the way of framing neoliberalism is not on a country by country basis, but as a global system of both open and closed societies. And this sort of interlocking network can be including places like China or Bangladesh or India or wherever, where there's, you know, differing degrees of so-called democracy or openness. Yet as a global system, it works. Yeah. And there's these kind of power stations of somewhere like Wall Street or London or Hong Kong, the centers of global capital. And one of the other kind of interesting mirrors to that is the development of tax havens. Like the Cayman Islands, you know, these classic kind of, you know, Epstein's Island, whatever, you know, these places where the capital can kind of hide away as well. And so one of the analogies that I've been reading about is how neoliberalism, you know, its namesake of classical liberalism, which very much mirrors the era of colonialism and is from that period of, you know, you get the spices from India or the timber from and the wool from New Zealand, you know, as my own experience, you know, even Canada, you know, these places, they have a colonial history. There's both colonized and colonizer. And so there's an interesting take where it's like, okay, what is the mirror of that? You know, is that Uniqlo making its t-shirts in Bangladesh? And, you know, the extractive side. Yeah. And again, that's a lens. I don't necessarily fully agree with that that lens, but it's quite interesting that there's parallels there that, you know, you can't have, you know, the Chinese factories without, you know, without Wall Street. And, you know, before the opening up, you know, China was a backwater. There was nothing coming out of China. And it was the opening up and the interface with global capital in the 80s that led to this kind of project where everything gets made in China and the money is all in the US. And that flow is necessarily a global system, which you could argue is beginning to break down. And so this is kind of the second half of Damon Silver's lecture. It was like, well, what's next? And we don't have to go into that now, but it's quite interesting that, okay, just like 1970s stagflation was the end of an era, potentially, you know, we're seeing the breakdown of the world's factory, which I would add sees the world as in a sense, there's this conspiracy theory of the flat earth. I don't know if you've come across it. It's kind of a funny one, but it's in a sense, it's kind of truthful in a sense that, the world is flat. It doesn't matter where your widget is made, whether it's China or Bangladesh or Thailand, the thing gets made and it gets shipped overnight, Amazon to your door. And that's, I think, that system is very strange. Like, okay, this is a moment in time where that was possible. And you could maybe see analogies with Europe at certain periods in the early 20th century where it's like, we've got the European, the League of Nations or whatever, but, that fell apart. And I wonder whether that's falling apart now as the neoliberal project sort of tries to redefine itself, but it doesn't even know what it is, So it's kind of quite, again, the paradox is coming through. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of variables in what you're saying. I do agree with the point that now all these countries do bend the knee to global capital, right? In a way, I think some of them have not realized yet. And one example that always fascinates me is the Chinese security state. Julian Assange always said that it doesn't really matter what you say in the West, because all the power really is in the interlocking of the contract and national security systems, right? That everything is a bunch of trade flows that are parties contracting to each other. If you don't mess with that, it doesn't really matter. I think China and other countries are still acting like it matters, even though they have actually bought into this more powerful kind of system of financial flows in and out, right? Of being not necessarily held hostage, but certainly of needing to understand, foreign direct investment and other things. Now, other countries, China, India, regardless, they can and will make decisions that anger global financial markets. I think China can make more of those. For example, Hong Kong, you can argue, is a stark example of this. But the overall dynamic is that China and all these other countries are now, it's really interesting because I think there's some state philosophers in China who want China to take over the global liberal project, neoliberal project, you can say. Their argument is basically that the United States is falling behind on leadership, is not allowing for trade flows to come through. So this global system of contracts, trade, globalization should be inherited by the Chinese. So in that sense, I actually do think that what Silver says is correct in the sense of like what China does can be perceived as part of this global system neoliberal extension. And you can see it because China's mirroring institutions. For example, the World Bank, is the Asian Infrastructure Bank. On the Chinese side, the multilateral trade agreements and everything like that, right? So there is kind of this idea of global capital flowing in and out. Now, where we go from here, I have probably a different point of view in the sense of like, I look at it from the lens of like state power, and I look at it from the lens of like state efficiency. And I think where I sit, I don't have any super special access or super special insight. But what I've realized about kind of where I sit in the world is I've kind of cradled two different cultures. And those two cultures happen to be the cultures that everyone cares about the most because they're the largest economies. It's like the United States and China. So going back and forth and having family and all this other stuff, I'm kind of cradling in between. And what I'm seeing beyond just the stagflation, because I don't think it's going to be an apples to apples thing. Because the 1970s, for example, that stagflation was quite different than what I think this stagflation will look like. And namely, just one salient fact, which is the United States has become a world oil exporter. In fact, one of, if not the largest. right? So just even the increase in the price of oil will not affect, I guess you could say, the G7 nations in the way it would have in the 1970s. But what I do see cradling this bridge is there seems to be a kind of nihilism across both China and the United States, especially among the younger generation. And I think this nihilism is coming from two places. One, it does not appear like their lives will be better than the previous generation's lives. And I think, look beyond the stagflation and everything related to that. I mean, there are going to be some components of that. Definitely unemployment is very high. Youth unemployment is quite high in China, for example. But really, there's that element. And there's also the element of, like, you know, you have whatever you think about AI or whatever, but it seems to have the potential to displace a lot of us soft-handed white-collar workers as well, right? So where do we go from here? I don't really know. I think that the neoliberal project in the way that we have defined has actually created more dependency on the state. I think Silver sums up a version of this argument in the sense of, like, because state institutions were so weak, you know, the response to something like COVID had to be disproportionate. I don't agree with him on that. I think states, this is my anti-state bias, were inherently, forget like the idea that they were weakened or captured. Like, if you're looking at it from the perspective of, like, just spend and overall, I think my personal stance is there's been a great illusion, which is that some of the things we associate as golden ages really have come about, yes, because of institutions and distribution of wealth to a certain degree, but really have come about because of our energy usage. That, you know, what we saw in the World Wars and the period after World Wars was really an echo of the mass commercialization of oil in the 1870s, in 1875. And I think what we are seeing is, forget even the naming of it, if it's states or markets, but there is a failure to deliver on the idea that life will be better in China or in the United States for most people. I actually think India is one of those rare exceptions where people are not as nihilist, from what I can understand. Like, Modi's support is very from the youth, apparently. I mean, this is more secondhand information. But the young in India, and India is still growing at, like, a reasonable clip, because I think it had a little bit of messiness before, and now, you know, it's trying to ascend to the neoliberal order. That does help you in the short term. Mm. No, like, the GDP growth rate will follow. Like, if you have, you know, more libertine organization of markets, as flawed as they can be in certain respects, I do think it does help in the short term. We saw that with China going from not allowing markets to having markets and the GDP growth that followed. India as well. But now you have this fundamental problem in both the United States and China, and you can argue there are adjacent countries as well, that people don't fundamentally believe in a better future. And that's kind of, like, been the promise. The promise has been that you will have a better future than your parents, right? And I don't think it's possible we may or may not achieve the energy breakthroughs to get there, but I'm not sure, and that presages some level of breakdown. I hate to say it in that, like, fourth turning kind of way, but maybe that's war. There's 30 million single men in China, for example, who, what is their energy and life force going to be dedicated to, right? Like, if they're not getting employment, and if they're not going to have a wife, and they're not going to have children, they're not going to have a family, where does that go, right? Mm. And I think we've been running this kind of, like, 200-year experiment of, like, also having countries without necessarily having transcendent values. And what I mean by that is, for example, in China and the United States right now, show me the money, right? It's never been more aligned. If you ask a young person in both countries, actually, I think the Americans will be more shy about this than the Chinese. And you ask them, what is their driving force, right? It's money, security, comfort, good career, all these other things. But there is no transcendental values. In China, that's expressed in the spiritual void. In the United States, I think there is this kind of, like, you know, laissez-faire attitude. And again, like, one of the things about the neoliberal project, which I think has been a second order consequence, has been this idea that, like, okay, markets are efficient in the short term, let them run how they will. We don't really necessarily have strong social or order or priorities around that, right? So I think that there might be some breakdown. I think that there's going to be new forms of governance. Some of them will be strong state. Some of them will accentuate the power of the state. I actually think most of them will. There's this really interesting book called The Fall of the West by Oswald Spengler that essentially predicts a version of this, that, like, the Western countries are going to have eventually descend into, like, Caesarian rule around this time. And I don't think I quite believe all of it, but it was quite prescient, just like how the sovereign individual is quite prescient in some ways. I think that book was also quite prescient. The Decline of the West was also quite prescient. I think that, you know, you're going to see consolidation of power. And in fact, you're seeing that right now. And it will be in the name of things like markets and
freedom,
Bitcoin and freedom and things like that. So yes, you will see that. I think you will see more war somewhat as a consequence of that potentially. I do think there are still some, you know, isolationist tendencies. So I'm not trying to predict this all the way out. But the general point is that, like, there could be more consolidation of power. My hope, my fervent hope as an ailing Bitcoiner who doesn't know quite if my ideal society will make it, or maybe my ideal society is a fool's dream, is that there will also be some sovereign individual-like setups that are not as elitist or inaccessible as what we discussed. I think the sovereign individual, is very prescient, because I believe, like, the writers were part of the early internet movement. So they really were kind of immersed in that milk. Mm. And so, you know, presaging the rise of cryptocurrencies and things like that, you know, quite prescient. But the ultimate prophecy that, like, everybody's just going to hop into a new form of society, some internet governance. And I think I see strands of this in The Network State by Balaji, which would be kind of like the modern day echo of this strand of thinking. I don't think that's going to happen either. And part of the reason why it's not going to happen is because of what you identified. It's more a vision for the elites.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's kind of, there's a couple of things I just want to reference here. So, firstly, the other kind of text we haven't talked about is David Harvey's A Brief History of Neoliberalism, right, which is quite influential. And that's certainly got a Marxist lens to it, a very left lens. But he writes in the beginning, he says how there's this kind of drive in society today. It's a kind of an entrepreneurial common sense. And we see this with, like, hustle culture and, like, content creators. And everyone is on the clock. Everyone's selling their time now. You know, there's not really sacred spaces, sacred time anymore, unless you can monetize. And he writes about, you know, this fetish belief is that there is a technological fix for every problem. And I think this is quite interesting, because this goes back even much further. You've got the technological state, which was Jacques Ellul's The Technological State, which talks about the same thing from, like, the 1950s. Then that kind of idea that, the AI is going to, you know, disrupt, and we're going to have the DAO utopia, I think all of that is, there's so many assumptions and axioms that that's based off that may not necessarily be true. And it's sort of, you know, if you go out and touch grass, and see reality, and it's like, it's I don't know if it's going to be like that. Because the other piece I would then contrast that back to with Beyond the New Right is this idea of society. And again, I think this is talking about the same thing, but from two different angles. One is our society is this kind of imposition. And again, this is like Margaret Thatcher's classic thing, that there is no such thing as society, it's just individuals. Versus, in fact, the kind of maybe localist thing, which I see strands of, in fact, in Bitcoin, you know, shake the farmer's hand, you know, kind of buy the eggs from the local dude, you know, with Bitcoin. Yeah, and which I'm quite enamored with that. But this idea of society, and then the breakdown of society. And so In Beyond You Write, the author talks about poverty, and it's certainly in Britain today, he's writing in the 90s, Britain today, poverty is a cultural artifact rather than merely an economic phenomena. And that is to say, the origins are in family breakdown, poor education, and a lack of human skills rather than in sheer stringency of resources. And I think this is quite telling because, you know, you look at the you know, downtown San Francisco or the, you know, New York in the 70s and 80s, you know, these kinds of classic images of poverty. What are they? Are they breakdowns of society? And this is where I think the fundamental critique, which I'm beginning to kind of wrap my head around, is that the idea that free markets will solve this and that we can just have a contract necessarily needs a civil society underneath it where you don't actually have to enforce the contract. And I think this is maybe something that goes over the heads of maybe some of the more technologically aligned Bitcoiners who think, okay, well, if we have a atomic swap, we have a, you know, a UTXO thing, you know.
Code is law.
Code is law. You know, I don't think that's, you know, law is law. And where does law get its legitimacy from? It's from the people and the sort of social structures that surrounds it. And so what if you ignore that, what you end up with is a, sort of a pernicious kind of state that will, you know, enforce laws and do what it does as, you know, without any regard for kind of the consensus of people. And that kind of, there's almost in a sense a kind of a, we always talk about consensus in Bitcoin, but then we also talk about code as law. It's kind of like, well, which one, right? They kind of intertwine a little bit, but fundamentally, you know, that civil society of, I leave my front door unlocked and I have a community garden in a park where, you know, walk the dog.
Right.
That's kind of like the good life of the embedded liberalism. And the kind of the future that I think is being talked about a lot in the network state, Epstein's Island, these kinds of things, you know, that effectively, it's getting away from that and an escapism. And I don't know how those two things can kind of be, how you can connect those, you know?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head in terms of some of the difficulties. I got into, let me put the like shiny BS version of it. I like to engage through dialectic. I'm just a guy behind a screen.
Me too, man.
You know, so let's not pretend I'm like Hegel or something. But like, I in talking with Bitcoin anarcho-capitalists who are fully, you know, fully down the Mises, Hayek, Rothbard route, right? And I count among them people who I consider to be, you know, great friends and allies in many different ways, right? So no slight on them or the way they think. I do think it's missing that critical element. And one thing I was trying to tell one particular individual in this roster was like, there is no civilizational ethos in this project that you're trying to build. Like, that's what I also left when I finished reading The Network State. That was also my conclusion. I was like, you defined some kind of tripolar thing that I think got China quite wrong, but you did not understand kind of like this civilizational ethos, like what inspires people to build it. The market and market mechanisms and technical solutions that come out of that are technological solutions. They are not social solutions. They are not trust solutions. They are not political solutions. And so at the end of the day, you still bump into the thorny question of governance. Even if your theory of governance is that no one should govern, right? You still bump into, well, okay, no one should rule. So then what happens, right? What are the consequences of that? I think the technical solution is kind of just to assume like, hey, we're going to make the tools available. And this is a very Hayekian view. It's like, if you have a free market, if you have the economy, forget for a level, like, I mean, there's a level of criticisms because of, you know, market inefficiencies and different things, the back and forth between Keynesian economics and neoclassical economics. And I should say that there was a period where you were kind of referring to like mercantilism. And I do think, to give Adam Smith and Ricardo their credit, they were not mercantilists. So I do wanted to tie that. But certainly this project of like bringing back kind of the free market, bringing back markets as a mechanism, as you've alluded to, markets have existed before the state. So bringing back this like new version of a market effectively that is state sponsored and state controlled and state pushed doesn't in of itself create a society and doesn't in of itself create an ethos or a philosophy. And in fact, it tries very hard not to do that. To Milton Friedman and Hayek's credit, to a certain degree, I think they both recognize that. I think they do both recognize that, that it's necessary but not sufficient in order to live the good life, as you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Now, where to go from there? I think the solution is not to embrace that technical solution. I challenge people all the time because they'll all be like, where is the anarcho-capitalist paradise? And the answer back is always like, this is the way things should be governed. Because if you look at like, you know, Pareto charts and you look at like optimum charts, and if you distort, you know, I did economics, so this is my life for like a while, right? If you look at all the line charts, you know, one is like slightly askew, so you got to like bring it back. You know, you got to have equilibrium. So that will make things better for all people, right? In theory. But it doesn't answer like any of the fundamental questions. It kind of goes back to the whole RFK quote, you know, GDP tells us everything about a society except for all the things that matter, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I love the localist strands of Bitcoin. I love that part too. I love going to the farmer's market. I love touching grass. I love going through. I think that ideally you would have some societies that take into account this idea of like, what does it take to build a meaningful civil society? And I think at some point that society will have to confront whether or not people are willing to live or die for it. Like not to be dramatic, but one example I always give is that there have been more instances of enduring anarcho-socialist, the original meaning of libertarian societies, than there are anarcho-capitalists. When I ask for anarcho-capitalist examples, I get like Somalia and like Ireland in like the 1300s or something. It's a very sparse corpus, right?
Yeah.
But you know, with anarcho-socialist societies, which are governed under this principle of, I think, for example, like there is some element of democracy, there is some element of like civil society, there is some element of freedom of speech and of councils and things like that. One example I always give, and of course, you know, every society has its downfalls and upfalls. I don't want to say Rojava is like this pure paradise, but you know, the Kurds in Syria have created a project that has endured through war. And that is because they have the Peshmerga, they have soldiers who are willing to put their lives on the line for this idea. And not necessarily because of transcendental values, but necessarily for the society that's being built. So I think we're going to have to confront all these different questions.
Yeah.
And I hope that we have some societies that are kind of like a mix where it's, you can pick and choose. Some people will like the strong state variants. Some people will like the weaker state variants. But all of them will have to figure out a lot more questions than just whether or not is the market the best way to organize ourselves economically.
Yeah. I've got a little quote here. The world is not just economic. It is political economic. And right. I think this sort of, I guess, summing up everything we've talked about, you know, for me, I think the great realization, which is perhaps the myopia of neoliberalism and some aspects of this kind of Austrian economics approach, is that it sees the sovereign individual as the island on his own, whereas in fact society as in nature depends on the order around it that we didn't invent, we inherited it, and this kind of flow of society. And one of the other things that John Gray writes about in Beyond the New Right is that fundamentally communism and fascism are single generation philosophies, because you cut off the past and you cut off the future. And my challenge with any of these kinds of totalitarian or you could argue perhaps enlightened ideas is that you know, this historical material tradition, you know, that whatever happened, you know, it's happened and it's finished, and then we're going to go to the paradise, but we never get to the paradise. We get cut off before we get to that. And I think where I kind of come back to my lived experience is that fundamentally the middle way and the kind of the messy, muddy politics of negotiation, of civil society, of the liberal arena is the place where, you know, the kind of the bedrock of society comes in, and that involves education, it involves community, it involves giving to the community in a sense where the idea that, you know, even if you've got free choice, if all of your choices suck, what are you going to do? And I think this is this is where we can see a lot of the emergence of, say, like petty crime and sort of social breakdown. It's like, well, if some kind of state isn't going to redistribute and kind of provide that welfare, we're going to go do it on our own, and we're going to smash the windows of a car in San Francisco and steal the radio, you know, kind of like that. That's a form of redistribution. And I think the sort of coming down on that and the kind of the heavy hand is obviously one solution. But it's like, okay, it's just kind of, it's not actually solving the underlying issue that there is an inequality, there is a social malaise, a nihilism, that, you know, there isn't a project that we're working towards. And so I think, you know, hard on crime, soft on crime, you know, I think those are kind of higher up the stack. It's more like, okay, what does it mean to be part of a society and to be part of a community? And this is kind of some human values, right? And I think kind of the atomic DAO, right, unique user ID of the sovereign individual of the internet, you know, that doesn't really lend itself to knowing your neighbor or being part of a community or a church or, you know, a social
values
group, you know. And I think I have a lot, man, I haven't got any answers here. And again, I am playing, we're playing a couple of angles in this conversation today, and I appreciate you coming along with me on this journey. But I guess the questions I kind of come out of this with, again, I don't have the answers, but what is the role of Bitcoin in society? What is the role of Bitcoin in the state? How can Bitcoin, which is here, you know, the cat's out of the bag, how can that provide a pathway for people like you and I, who are not elite, you know, we're just plebs, to actually have a voice and to have a little bit of a bit of that power, you could say, that was previously only available to, you know, Epstein and his island, you know, and these kinds of people. That, you know, this is being decentralized. Maybe I shouldn't use that, you know, that example. I would say the kind of power that was available only to the elite, which is, you know, it is available now to people who are maybe not elite. And so what does that mean for the dynamics? Does that actually sort of bring us back down to more of a middle place? I don't know. What do you think? What are sort of maybe some concluding questions or sort of framings you'd like to leave people with?
Yeah, let me wrap everything up. I did notice throughout our conversation that you were strongly hinting at, you know, the labor union part. So I'm going to bring that in right at the last moment here.
Okay.
And then I'll wrap everything up with a bow tie, hopefully. You know, I think Bitcoin, in a sense, and we have to be careful with this, again, with the thing with saying technical solutions are necessary but not sufficient. I think that Bitcoin can play somewhat of a role similar to what unions used to play in the past. Now, we live in an era where labor, no matter how you want to think about the factors, and certainly, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that decline of unionism might be one of them. Right. And decline of unionism in a very not just in an institutional sense, but actually in a like complete shift sense. Like, for example, most people are now contract workers or gig workers. Right. So the factory workers of before are now kind of like in this very perilous situation where they have no protections and they have essentially what is promised to them, some version of market freedom. But in fact, it's kind of like what you said, you have freedom of choice, but all of your choices are bad, right? So what can you do with that? And that's also true in China and the States. There's a lot of really good articles and human interest stories if people want to read about the gig workers who are now coming of age in China, because now it's been long enough that you have some of the people who have worked gig work for their entire lives now at this point. And, you know, they're retiring and they have all these healthcare issues and they have no power and they have no negotiating power, no stakes. I think that in the right context, some level of being exposed to Bitcoin and being part of the Bitcoin community can allow even laborers to negotiate and leverage their power a little bit more. I think this probably happens in one or two ways. One way is that, you know, with savings, you kind of get out of the paycheck to paycheck grind. And so certainly, I mean, some of us are more fortunate than others. Of course, if you were here in 2012 or 2011, you might already be racing drones or collecting lizards or whatever you want to do, right? But certainly there is some of that effect of, I think, like getting people outside of this most precarious of situations, right? I think also there is like an ethos of like knowledge. So it's like, I do think being exposed to the Bitcoin community does help think about, you know, these level questions about inflation, about, you know, how can I persist and how can I think through things. That's where it's kind of a little bit interesting, because I do think the Bitcoin part is, for me at least, more the community than the actual tool. And the community actually helps the tool a lot. And in a sense, I use it in a way that requires the community, and that's very deliberate. So for example, for peer-to-peer trading, you have to know people within the community. So in a sense, it is actually very rooted in some kind of a social ethos. But it is not in of itself sufficient to be able to answer the grand questions of how to live the good life, right? How do you trust your neighbor? How do you decide what happens? How do you give voice to your kind of inner expression, right? These are not necessarily questions that are answered by Bitcoin. But I do think Bitcoin does help slightly on the margins with that. Having said that, of course, it is also a tool used by elites. And this is not just, I know you've referenced Epstein's Island several times, but, you know, it's not just the American elites, it's the Chinese elites, it's all kinds of elites. It's whoever has capital now, right? Because it is still a tool of capital at the end of the day, people who buy it. Now, nominally, the system is still determined somewhat by its laborers, i.e., like, you can argue that a maintainer is worth a lot more than Michael Saylor in terms of the trajectory of where the project goes, right? That is one of the more romantic elements of Bitcoin as is. But I think where I'm at, and just to conclude, I think, Cody, I really appreciate you inviting me. I feel like you have been wrestling with a very great question of which it cannot be expected to have an answer anytime soon, actually, I think. But I think you're hitting the question, the nail on the head. It's like, how can we persist and live the good life? How can we structure ourselves? How can we be in a society without coming to this escapism of like, oh, it's going to figure itself out, or like the internet is around, so everybody is, which is kind of the sovereign individual argument, right? It's like the internet is around, so therefore governments will collapse, right? Or, you know, Bitcoin is here, so I don't have to think about anything except for stacking like 10 Bitcoin, right? Now, in practice, I don't think there's a lot of people who think in this extreme way. But I do think that the more people are nuanced and start wrestling with the humility you have, that question, I think it's going to be really, really important. And I don't have an answer. You ask me, like, how do I see the world going? And I profess some level of humility to that. I don't really know. I don't even know what Trump is going to do tomorrow. So how can I even, how can I even predict, or she, for that matter, right? And those are two people that are driving the course of the world, you could say, right now, for better or for worse. So I think some humility, some question seeking, and I really love that you brought many, many perspectives to the table. Some of them that are anathema for Bitcoiners, like even referencing Marx or even alluding to the fact that you might have read Marx or something like that, right? Which I think is a very incomplete philosophy as well. So kudos to you for the show. Hopefully this is useful or something, yeah. Amusing or entertaining. And
oh, yeah. Thank you. I very appreciate it, man. And I sort of reached out to you. I mean, I've been wrestling with these things, as you say, and just to talk to someone about it and to, again, frame it and couch it in a way that isn't aligned necessarily with a single lens, but, you know, looking at this, zooming out, the reason as well, I mean, people have been talking to me, people email me and say, hey, Cody, what's going on? You know, there's something's happened. You know, I'm not really on X much these days. It's, you know, the kind of the story of Bitcoin, the kind of the golden age of you know, sovereign, you know, the sovereign individual and separating money. So it's like, okay, where did that go to? You know, did we end up with treasury companies? You know, is that it? Are we done? I don't believe so. I think there's a lot more to this, and what it requires is just a little bit of time and effort, a little bit of proof of work, reading some of the texts. I think, you know, a lot of the stuff we talk about, I find it's like we're reproducing debates that have happened in the non-Bitcoin world like 30 years ago, and we think it's unique, but actually no, people have been critical of the state of money, of all sorts of things from all sorts of angles. And I think this is really important because, yeah, if we stick to the Austrian angle, you know, we take that as truth, as gospel, free market fundamentalism, you know, we miss out on a lot. I think we must steel man and look at the other side and see, okay, how does the left look at it? How do the conservatives look at it? How do other parties sort of grapple with this question? And I think that leads to a place of truth. And honestly, I think dialogue is the most important thing. So I appreciate you coming on, Roger. And yeah, I wish you all the best and hope we can keep in touch.
Yeah, sounds good. And just to end on that, I think it was a really elegant note, Cody. Read your enemies. And that, I'm out.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.